Anybody that comes in late will just have to miss the first part. I'm hitting record. All right, so please volunteer for the hot seat now. We're going to need lots of volunteers tonight, and some of you can have a couple go around. I'm going to bring up lots of questions too that are ones that you sent in. If you see one that really strikes you, then you want to be in the hot seat for that question, then volunteer a second time. I want to start with a story, and the story goes like this. A man is chipping away at a giant rock pillar, and a little boy is watching him do it. And finally, the little boy asks him, "What are you doing? You know, it's out here in the hot sun." And Michelangelo replies, "There's an angel inside here, and I'm trying to set him free." So what this story illustrates is kind of what we do in our lifetimes. It's like we're just kind of chipping away at our lives, ourselves, and we're trying to set ourselves free. We're trying to make us into our most magnificent selves. It's in there somewhere, right? We just got to chip away at all the cement around it or the rock around it. So here's the bottom line of everything that we've explored so far is animals are just who they are. You know, I talked about Bambi and animals' relationship with fear, and they just who they are. You know, they feel the fear, they feel angry sometimes, sometimes they're sad, right? But humans resist who they are. That's what we do. It takes a lot of effort, though, to not be who you are. And we work so hard at it. I'm reminded of a story of Jim and Joe, who started an ashram, and it became really popular. But what they would do is they would sit around and chant, "I am humble, I am nothing. I am humble, I am nothing." Pretty soon they had thousands and thousands of followers. And their buddy Biff was walking by a few years later, and he's like, "Oh my gosh, there's that ashram that Jim and Joe started." Biff goes inside and nods to Jim and Joe. They haven't seen each other for a while. And Biff sits down, and he also starts chanting, "I am humble, I am nothing. I am humble, I am nothing." And Jim and Joe kind of smack each other and roll their eyes at Biff and say, "Huh, look who thinks he's nothing." This story, funny, but illustrates how much we work so hard to not be who we are or try to change things. And really all that we seek to do in those moments is to feed into our own delusion. So I don't want to help you feed into your own delusion by offering you some sort of, a humbleness practice, or maybe a practice of gratitude or forgiveness or fearlessness or joy or all those wonderful things that we see in America as practices. Because all that those tend to do, like Jim and Joe and ultimately Biff over time, is to feed into our own delusion and deny ourselves kind of the truth of who and what we are, which is that we also struggle with a tremendous amount of fear. I found that there are two types of people who are willing to do this kind of practice. Those who have lots of fear, anxiety, stress, right? And the repression, of course, is obvious in those moments. But there are a lot of others, and some of you have kind of written me that are on this webinar, who don't feel a lot of fear. And it's like, well, what am I doing on this webinar? But the thing is, because fear is there every single moment of every single day and every interaction we have, you know, it's actually there underneath our relative reality. And if we're willing to look beneath that, you know, we'll find it, but we've compensated in some way. Maybe we've gotten really good at ignoring it. Maybe we've gotten really good at numbing out in the face of fear. Maybe we become stoic or tough or impenetrable, like I was during my ski career. Maybe some of us lack essential vulnerability as a result of this. And this fear, this undealt with fear, shows up instead as blame, like throwing it on other people or burnout or just being tired all the time. Or eventually we just drug ourselves so that we don't have to deal with fear. So I'm worried about the folks who are willing to admit that they have a fear problem, but in many ways, I'm more worried about the folks that aren't willing to admit that they have a fear problem. Like they don't even know that they're in prison. And if you don't even know you're in prison, you can't get out, which is what happened to me during my ski career. So if you feel like you don't have any fear, which is what I was like during my ski career, I really felt fearless, then that was just kind of me really struggling with a tremendous amount of fear that I was not dealing with, that I was pushing down, that eventually started taking over my life and causing me a lot of problems. So The good news is the first types, the ones that are willing to admit that they have problems with excessive fear or anxiety, they tend to be more willing to get help, and maybe that's you. The second types are less willing to get help around the subject of fear, but may be willing to address a single problem regarding fear. And so all of what I've said is kind of leading to this moment. It's like you guys have submitted your problems, but just notice which one you are. Are you willing to admit that you have a problem with fear or anxiety? Or do you feel like, oh no, really my problem is I just have insomnia or I have too much clutter on my desk? You know, it's all related to fear. So let's get to work on this. When it comes to problems, I would say that either completely it comes back to your relationship with fear, or on some level, it all comes back to the relationship with fear, either completely or on some level. So which is why, of course, I'm in the business of fear, addressing fear. And what we're going to do tonight is address any kind of effort that we take regarding fear to not be who you are, not be who we are. So I want you to notice how much energy you spend avoiding fear right now. It's easy to forget fear. It's easy to forget the unpleasant side of life, but sometimes it just takes a lot more energy than you realize. It's also painful to be who you are. It's very painful to own your shit. It's very painful to own your fear or your anger or your powerlessness or your guilt or your shame. Like, I get it. Growth is not a comfortable thing. It's hard to do this. It's hard to do this work. It's hard to study the self. But sometimes, and here's our turning point, it becomes more painful not to own your shit. It becomes more painful not to study yourself. And so this is kind of the shift that hopefully we're in, where we're willing to look at our shit because it's harder not to. And I'm reminded of a quote by Christy Alexander. I'm sure I'm butchering her name, but the short-term pain of facing a truth is far better than the long-term pain of believing a lie. So I'm going to help you. What we're going to do tonight is we're going to bring it all home. It's not about freedom from suffering. It's more about freedom to suffer. And that's what we're going to be focusing on. Not about freedom from suffering, but we're going to give ourselves freedom to suffer, like permission to suffer. And the great news with this is, how do you grow without suffering or be human? And why would you want to not suffer? You'd have no ability for empathy. You would have a false sense of power over your life. I want you then tonight, and moving forward from having worked with me, to bring basically the cojones, the balls, to feel your pain, to not hide it, to not hide from it, and instead examine it and live your truth. That's the path to freedom. So you bring the balls, right? I'll bring the method. Train needs steam and tracks to get somewhere. So you bring the steam, you bring the passion, the right heart, and I'll bring the direction, the right mind. Because if you're missing steam, if you're missing tracks, you're just not going to get anywhere. I'm going to help you feel your fear. Now, maybe you're still thinking, like, okay, I don't want to feel my fear. I don't want to empower my fear. It just seems kind of insane, you know, especially the way that we've been conditioned in our society. But I promise you, if you do this, you'll free up a lot of energy. And we always get to a place then of peace, aliveness, a clear mind, compassion, more tolerance for yourself, for your bad moods, for other people, and ultimately freedom. So, let me just check in with my assistant and make sure that we have any volunteers. Please volunteer, and I am going to go through a four-step Art of Fear method, and this is our practice tonight. And then I'm going to answer all your questions. So who do we have for volunteers?
Kristen, you need to promote me to a co-host.
Okay, how do I do that?
Click on my name.
Okay.
And then click co-host.
All right.
There we go. Thank you.
Great. So as you can tell, I'm doing this remotely right now, and I'm in Florida. So three participants raised their hand, and my lovely assistant, Kirk, is going to send me the names of volunteers. But let's go through the four-step art of fear method, which is kind of going to be the basis for your entire practice moving forward. So let's wait. Okay, here we go. We have Teresa. So Teresa, why don't you unmute yourself and let's get started. Great. So Teresa, I'm going to walk you through the four-step art of fear practice. And I know that we've worked together before, so this is going to be probably easier for you, but you don't have that much experience too with this four-step art of fear practice. So you ready to go?
I am.
Okay. So the first step is, and let me just tell you why I made this first step the first step, because we're so in our heads about fear that I wanted to do something that really appealed to our analytical thinking mind. And so the first step is, I want everybody, including you, to acknowledge that it is absolutely normal and natural to feel fear. It's normal and natural even to feel unworthy or shame or guilt or anger or any of these things. It's not a sign of personal weakness. It's not a character flaw. And as we go through this four-step art of fear method, just know that it's supposed to last about 2 or 3 minutes, this whole process. And I always start by acknowledging this as the first step, normal and natural, for about 15 seconds. So Teresa, you and me, let's just acknowledge that right now, usually in silence. I'm going to keep moving on though. The second step of my four-step art of fear method that is going to help you resolve a lot of your problems related to fear is, I want you, and we'll do this together, Teresa, right now, do what's called a body scan. This is the second step. So close your eyes and kind of scan your body, and maybe it's in your mind too. I want you to notice what it is that you feel. And in particular, I want you to notice any discomfort that you feel. And give it a name. Like for me, I feel a tightness in my head, and I feel anxiety in my chest. So identify what it is that you feel, tightness, anxiety, where it is that you feel it in your head, in my head, and in my chest. What do you feel, Teresa?
I feel it in my chest, and I also feel my feet sweating.
Okay. But what do you feel? Give it a name.
I feel my heart beating in my chest, just increased heartbeat.
Okay, so maybe a racing heartbeat or?
More like a pounding heartbeat.
Right? Okay, because you're in the hot seat?
Maybe, but I usually feel it in my chest.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So that's the what, that's the where. And then on a scale of 1 to 10, 10 being high, how strong does it feel right now? For me, it feels like it's higher than normal. It's a 5 because I am doing this remotely and I don't have my lovely assistant Kirk to help me and be my fall guy for chat. How strong is it for you, Teresa?
I would say probably a 4.
All right. Keeping in mind our equation, suffering equals discomfort times resistance. So you have a discomfort of a level 4. I have a discomfort of a level 5. That's the second step. The third step is notice your relationship with that discomfort. This is where we're all about the resistance. What is your relationship with that discomfort? Do you hate it? Do you wish it weren't so? Are you ignoring it? Are you avoiding it? Are you trying to rationalize it away or calm it down in any way?
I do feel myself trying to calm it down a little. So I would say I'm resistant to it, but not much higher, probably around like a 3 or a 4.
Okay. My resistance to it is higher than normal too, because I didn't get a chance to do my four-step art of fear practice before I got on this web. So it feels like it's about a 4. So times your 2 numbers together and you get your level of suffering, you know, without a possibility of a total 100, because it's 10 times 10 or 0 times 0. So it's on a scale of 1 to 100. So I have 5 times 4, not that much, not too bad. So just to back up, first step of my four-step Art of Fear method is it's normal and natural to feel discomfort. You know, you do that for 15 seconds, you really acknowledge it, use your rational mind. The next two steps are all about awareness. And I talk all the time about how we used to say knowledge is power. It's actually not true in today's world. The last person that said knowledge is power said it, well, the person that said it first said it in the late 1400s when we believed that the world was still flat. And I think the only reason why we still say knowledge is power is because that's teachers' ploy to get kids to pay attention in school. It's actually not true anymore. What is more true in today's world, and that's why so much of the Art of Fear method is around this, is awareness is power. So steps two and three are all about the awareness. First of all, what do I feel? Where do I feel it? And how strong is it? And then the awareness of my resistance. And then the third step is actually, I would say, the most important step in almost every single question that we're going to address tonight. So really kind of remember that one. And then the fourth step of my four-step Art of Fear method is that we then spend some time feeling whatever it is that feels stronger. Does your discomfort feel stronger, or does your resistance feel stronger? So for me, my resistance feels stronger. Teresa, which feels stronger for you, your discomfort or your resistance?
I say the discomfort.
Okay. So then, fourth step, I'm going to spend about a minute. I'm going to feel my resistance, and you're going to feel your discomfort. And we're going to do this without trying to get rid of it. And I'm probably not going to do it because I don't want to have everybody just sit here while I'm, you know, quiet with my eyes closed for the next minute, but I want you to do it. So I just want you to feel your discomfort now. And I'm going to keep talking, but close your eyes. Feel it without trying to get rid of it for at least a minute, and I'll check in a minute to see how you feel. For the rest of you, I'm just going to keep talking. So, four steps. Acknowledge it's normal and natural to feel discomfort. Do that for 15 seconds. Second step. What do I feel? Where do I feel it? And how strong is it? And that'll take you about 15 to 20 seconds to kind of acknowledge once you get the hang of it. Third step. What is my relationship with this discomfort? Do I have any kind of resistance to it? How am I treating it? Am I, you know, fingers in the ears? You know, that takes about 20 seconds as well. And then the last step, you just spend some time feeling whatever it is that you're feeling, your resistance, your fear, your anger, your sadness, whatever the discomfort is, your anxiety. You could also spend some time feeling both the resistance and the discomfort in the fourth step. So let's check in with Teresa. Teresa, how are you feeling?
I am feeling more relaxed. My heart has, it's calmed down. My chest is calmed down, and I feel better.
So see how simple that is. It's like, here's the discomfort just speaking in your ear. And what do we tend to do? You've seen me do this before. We turn away from it. We ignore it. We go distract ourselves from it. We rationalize it away. We fight it with a sword. But if you instead turn towards it, like I've been teaching you guys for the last three webinars, then let it speak, you know, like a whining child, give it your complete attention. It calms right down. So that's our fourth step Art of Fear method. I'm going to send you a one-page printout after this webinar that outlines this in simple steps. And just, but keep this four-step Art of Fear method in the back of your mind as I start to address all the questions that we're facing tonight. I received quite a few questions, probably about 13 of them. And before we move on though, Teresa, is there anything else that you want to say about this experience? I don't know if you do the four-step Art of Fear method. I've shown it to you before. Anything else you want to say?
I would say that when we, on the last webinar on Monday, when you had us actually just allow the thinking, the monkey mind to, you know, just be in the monkey mind and let it come all out. And it, I don't think I had a chance to comment on it then. I found that it just all of a sudden went silent. I was like, I have all these things in my head. I know they're there. And But as soon as I put the attention towards it, I couldn't believe how much it quieted down. So I have been practicing this, and it's been very effective so far. Thank you.
Well, I'm very glad that you are the first volunteer, because you've done it before. People on our webinar list have done this before or even heard about it. It's not in my book. It's something I've come up with since the book. So thank you for speaking such a testimonial.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And
whenever you feel any kind of discomfort, whether it be monkey mind, fear, any other kind of emotion, any other kind of belief that is negative, all of that, you know, this Art of Fear method is a wonderful tool to just help you deal with it in an honest way, calm it down without repressing it. Oh my gosh, right? So I'm going to say that again. It's a way to calm that feeling, that awful, unpleasant feeling down, or at least reduce the suffering around it, but it also dissipates. It goes sometimes from a level 10 down to a level 0, and you're doing it, though, without repressing it. So let's keep moving on, and I'm going to tell you all the questions that were asked tonight so that you can brace yourself for all the real estate we're going to cover. Real quick, and I'm going to start reading these now. How do I manage severe anxiety that leads to panic attacks? Will mindfulness meditation help? And if not, what to do instead? Now, notice that your questions that you sent me are going to be in here. Those of you that didn't submit questions, hopefully you'll find these interesting. How do I deal with speaker's anxiety? In sports, as I get older, how do I deal with growing fear of getting injured? How and when do the blinding physical side effects of fear calm down? How will the body know when to calm down? How to deal with setbacks? When should I pull in my thinking mind or intellectually reflect on emotions? Where is anxiety coming from? Should we practice mindfulness? And then my two last minute additions, I have a clutter control problem preventing me from using my gifts at work. And then step by step, what to do in skiing when I have a meltdown, emotional meltdown, so it doesn't affect my performance. So in no particular order, I'm going to start answering these. And know that you can submit other questions in the Q&A, and I will look at them at some point. But let's get started. I'm going to need another volunteer. This is going to be very short. And so maybe let's have Teresa back on. So okay. I'm myself, and let me just talk for a second. Here's the thing about anxiety. I say in my book that anxiety is fear, fear is anxiety. It's just another word for it. More specifically, anxiety is fear that is kind of recirculating when there's no perceived threat. Like, okay, if somebody goes boo, yeah, fear shows up. But if you're just kind of feeling that anxiety low or high grade all the time and there's no actually something boo or a snake or anything, it's still fear. And what happens, what's great about anxiety, it's kind of like an alarm clock that gets progressively louder and louder and louder until you have to do something about it, and then you sign up for my webinars. So that's the good news. But let's explore through voice dialogue, through Shift the Game of 10,000 Wisdoms, what actual anxiety is. So allow me, Teresa, please, to speak to the voice of the one who's unwilling to feel fear or deal with fear. Whom am I speaking to?
The one who unwilling to deal with fear.
Right. So all of us, let's do this voice. Let's just shift right now. Close our eyes. And just notice how you feel physically. I don't want to deal with fear, and I'm absolutely unwilling. So as the voice of the one who's unwilling to deal with fear, how do you feel physically?
Kind of panicked and anxious. Yeah, unsure.
Now, there's a great wisdom to this voice. During my ski career, during Kristen's ski career, I was completely around in her life. I was absolutely unwilling to feel fear, and so I also became very rigid and tough and kind of stoic and arrogant. It's like there's kind of a compensatory physical reaction when you show up. To not kind of hold that tension so that fear can't penetrate, fear can't get out, fear can't come into our kind of rational mind. So notice that you kind of can be good in certain circumstances. But if you felt this way after 10 years, you know, if you're the voice who's like the CEO of Teresa's Corporation, what then happens?
I don't know that others would really pay attention to what I am having to say. They just look at me like I'm a know-it-all and that I'm in charge and like you said, tough. And I'm not sure that I'd be able to work with others very well.
Right. And so you're just one kind of way that this voice manifests, or what I just outlined. This is kind of one way in which you manifest as a voice. I'm unwilling to feel fear. And we see people like this, like I'm not afraid of nothing. And how they come across is their personality. But there's other people come out. I mean, if 7.5 billion different people had you as their CEO, you would show up in 7.5 billion different ways. So I'm just kind of giving you right now. Just notice the tension, the anxiety, the panic that you said that you feel. And more often than not, that's what anxiety is you.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So thank you.
Yeah.
I'm going to move on. Next question. And we're going to kind of rapid fire these because we have a lot of ground to cover tonight. And so giving you an overview, hopefully take notes. Hopefully I answer your question. And hopefully it's kind of like we're having a grand buffet and maybe you ordered the chicken teriyaki, but now I'm going to start to you a bite of that sushi. So it's like you're going to get to think questions and that you're going to have. All right. The next question is, how do I manage severe anxiety that leads to panic attacks? Well, panic attacks are quite simply, of course, fear, loss, displacement, your guard is dropped. It comes out kind of in a panic form, like a tsunami of that emotion. So the moment you don't own a voice, you become a victim to it. You know, it's a very weak place to operate from in your life. But if you do own it and take 100% responsibility for that voice, you become a master. So a short, succinct way of saying that is to avoid is weakness, to own is powerful. So whenever any voice is owned, we always come back to the same place. I talked about this before, freedom, peace, aliveness, clear mind, compassion, tolerance. And that's why it's really important if you have such severe anxiety that it leads to panic attacks that you have a fear practice. And it really is going to be resolved if you start this four-step Art of Fear method. And I want you, if you have panic attacks, to spend most of your attention on feeling your resistance first and then your fear. And I want you, if you have panic attacks every single day, to at least do this Art of Fear method once. And like I said, it doesn't have to last very long, just a few minutes. But if you're having a lot of panic attacks, if you have really, really bad anxiety, what I want you to do is do this Art of Fear practice 10 times a day or more, or right around that number, or whenever you're starting to feel anxious again. So not only would the method calm you down in that moment without having to repress fear, but over time, and it shouldn't take very long, maybe even just a week, you're going to start to feel so much better. So remember, I'm going to send this one-page document to everybody on the list. And so if this is your question, if this is your problem, you know, print it out and get to work. Sound good? Next question. How do I deal with speaker's anxiety? The person who wrote this, let me just read this, has to occasionally speak in front of groups of 150 to 200 people and feels speaker's anxiety, thinks practicing more with Toastmasters and taking little anxiety medication, which works, but makes this person feel dull. So, the thing about practicing, it definitely reduces fear. Like, if you're just kind of only stepping a little bit out of your comfort zone, it's less fear. And so, you know, the more you do speeches, you know, you don't do them where it matters. You do them in front of a Toastmasters group instead of people that are paying you. You know, it's a lot less fear and you can just kind of build your comfort zone until when you do speak in front of 200 people, you're not as much out of your comfort zone. It doesn't feel so scary. Now, I don't recommend taking drugs, right? And that's one way, but it's a lot of work. You know, signing up for Toastmasters, I had a girlfriend that did it. It took over her life. She was way into it. It's really fun. It definitely will make you a better speaker. But as for reducing speakers' anxiety, there are faster ways to do that, namely 4-step art of fear method. So here's the thing about fear and you. You must have these three things for any kind of partner, teacher, friend, lover, child, right? Love, trust, and respect. So do you have it for yourself? Do you have it for fear? Do you have love, trust, and respect for fear? Do you have it for all the 10,000 voices? So let me just tell you what I did the last time I did a big time speech. It was in front of a room full of about 200 people. And it was a room full of people that could really make a huge difference in my career. And I needed to nail this speech. And so going back to our 4-step method, what I did, I'm about to go on stage. And of course, the fear in advance, the 2 months beforehand, made me write a great speech, made me become super prepared. I practiced a lot. I knew the speech cold. And yet, I was still feeling absolute anxiety before the speech. Now, I'm a fear specialist, and I'm about to talk on the subject of fear and anxiety and what to do about it. And I'm like having practically a panic attack, right? And I'm about to go on 15 minutes beforehand. So what I did was I went and found a quiet place behind the building, and it only took me 3 minutes. I did the 4 steps. I acknowledge that it's normal and natural for me to feel fear and anxiety. Of course, this is a big speech. It's an important speech. I don't want to blow it. It's normal and natural for me to feel this. And in many ways, that can be very life-changing, just that alone, for anybody. The second thing is I then did a body scan. I closed my eyes and I identified what I felt, which was anxiety, where I felt it was in my chest. And on a scale of 1 to 10, how strong it was a level 10. I mean, that's how strong it was. And then the third step, I identified my resistance to it. And my resistance was also a level 10. And it was showing up as, I don't want to do this. I don't want to be here. I don't want to give this speech. I just want to be home with my husband cuddling on the couch. I don't want to do this. I don't want to do this. I don't want to do this. And so what I did, because they were both level 10s, I then spent a minute just feeling my resistance without trying to get rid of it. And then I spent, because it calmed right down, actually after about a minute, the resistance calmed down from a level 10 to a level 0, because I know how to do this, right? And then I spent another minute feeling my anxiety. And I'm not trying to get rid of it during this practice, I'm just feeling it, and that's it. And it too, once it got undivided attention from me, calmed down to a level 0. And next thing you know, 0 times 0, I was not suffering anymore. I went and gave the speech 15 minutes later, and I nailed it, and I wasn't pickled in anxiety. So that's what you do for performance anxiety when you're about to give a speech, for kind of anything, actually. So moving on. You can see we have a lot of questions to cover, so I'm just kind of targeting a few of these, and maybe some of you have questions, but I'm looking at my list. I'm not looking at the webinar page. So I'll, in just a few moments, I'm going to switch over to the webinar page to see if anybody has any Q&As, and I'll come back to them. So do submit Q&As if you want further clarification on anything I'm outlining. All right. Here's one of my last minute ones. Clutter control problem preventing me from using my gifts at work. Clutter is kind of a lesser version of hoarding, and it's definitely a sign of repressed emotions. I actually had the hoarding convention want me to give their keynote in Salt Lake a couple years ago. I turned them down because I didn't know enough about it, but then I kind of got a little fascinated with the whole show Hoarders. So hoarding has... there's a lot of issues, but I think that the primary one is repressed emotions, like, or just things that they don't want to deal with, and other personal work needs. And how do I know this? Because whenever I do personal work, whenever my husband does personal work, whenever my friends do personal work, like we go to a therapist or we do some sort of emotional kind of releasing, like a big cry, there's like an emotional purge in us, kind of cleans out your head. The first thing I want to do is go home and clean out a drawer or clean my house, you know, or make my bed. So if you have a clutter problem that's preventing you from using your gifts at work, if you get to work having a fear practice or a shadow practice or whatever it is, I won't deal with practice, which usually has something to do with fear, then you will just organically, naturally want to start cleaning up your desk because your head is no longer cluttered. You don't want your life and your world around you to also be cluttered. Like however your internal world is reflected in how you keep your house is what I'm trying to say. So let me just shift over real quick and see if there's any Q&As. Nope. All right. Let me go back to the questions and feel free to kind of put them in there anytime you want. Back to the clutter guest, then I recommend, of course, four-step art of fear method. Anybody that's on this webinar series, no matter what your reason for signing up, the four-step art of fear method will have something to do with helping you feel better, reducing your discomfort, reducing your resistance, and thus reducing your suffering. Things clear up, place of freedom, yada, yada. You know, there's more that you can do, but this webinar is about fear. So that's what I'm going to keep focusing on. Okay. Next question. How and when do the blinding physical side effects of fear calm down? And I'm going to combine these two questions. How will the body know when to calm down? How and when do the blinding physical side effects of fear calm down? Well, we've kind of already addressed that a little bit. You know, if you're in resistance to fear, never. But if you turn towards it, you know, I've seen people that have, you know, whoever wrote this question, blinding physical side effects, I suspect that you're feeling a lot of fear, a lot of anxiety. I found that with this art of fear method, certainly you can calm it down just with 1 minute, like I did with Teresa. If this is your first time doing the art of fear method, you might want to carve out like 10 minutes just to feel your fear. And the longer you feel it, you know, the more it calms down. And that'll give you a temporary relief in that moment. Without having to repress the fear, of course, but it'll come back because you have a long habitual pattern of not dealing with your fear. You'll just kind of go unconscious and then you'll stop, you know, dealing with your fear again. But if you keep this up, if you continue to do the art of fear method with the panic attack person, I actually suggested you do it up to 10 times a day. You know, they say if you do something for 20 times, it becomes your new habitual pattern. So I just recommend that not only will it calm down in the moment, but the more you do this, the more your fear will just permanently calm down. And I want to read what this person wrote to me. Now that we've learned, and I hope to master, the need to let fear out of the basement, when does the unpleasant physical side effects start to get under control? For instance, adrenaline and increased heart rates that can almost blinding overpower overpowering the fear world should be diminished. Okay, I'm not sure if I read that right, but I know these are triggers that can be healthy as we become friends with fear, but how will the body know, capital letters, when to stop the overproduction of these hormones and reactions? So I'd like to have another volunteer. This is going to be a short one. Maybe we can get Alicia on here?
Sure.
Okay.
Here I am.
All right, that was fast. So looking at this question, let me just read it again. When does the unpleasant physical side effects start to get under control? I mean, just look at the language there, under control. You know, next thing you know, we want to control the side effects. We want to control the body. You know, how will the body know when to stop the overproduction of these hormones reactions? First of all, I want to address that the body doesn't produce these hormones and reactions. I mean, it does, but it all starts with the lizard brain. Like the lizard brain sends a shot of fear to the body, And then there's adrenaline and cortisol and all these things that the scientists know that, these hormones, these reactions that also get kind of produced in the body. It all starts from the lizard brain, but it's, I think that what this person is asking is, how can I then control the side effects? How can I then control the fear? It's like, we're back, now I want to control the body. I want to control the reactions. So let's just check in real quickly with the start of this whole process. You ready?
I think so.
Okay. Allow me, please, if you remember from our first webinar, to speak to the voice of the lizard brain.
Okay.
Well, who am I speaking to?
I'm the lizard brain.
Right. So just looking at her question, she's just hoping that she's going to do this whole process as a way to get fear under control, stop the body from producing hormones, reactions, that kind of thing. You're the lizard brain. You're part of the brain. Two almond-sized nuggets at the top of the spine determining safe or not safe. It's kind of a complicated question, and you're kind of more simple. You're just concerned with safe versus not safe. How do you feel about somebody asking this question?
You have to repeat the question again. How to control, you mean about how to control the physical side effects associated with fear?
Right. So you're the lizard brain, right?
Okay. And how do I feel about that? Well, as the lizard brain, my role is to protect my boss. And so since I really don't have a complex way to do that, I really just have to either do fight or flight. So I feel that that's my only way of expressing myself to my boss.
Right. So you send a shot of fear to the body, and she starts to think about it, and she has these goals in mind. She wants to get it under control. She wants to kind of stop the body from shooting out these hormones and reactions. And, what I'm trying to get at is that I'm warning this person to be careful not to do this, like having this goal in mind. It's kind of like turning to you. Like, let's say we do our 4-step art of fear method. It honors you. It honors fear. But if I turn to you, lizard brain, and say, hey, I'm going to honor you and listen to you, and if I do this, will then you shut the hell up? How does that make you feel?
Well, actually, as long as I'm considered, I trust my boss. I really trust Alicia to make decisions for her own interest. And
are?
Pardon me?
Are you sure?
I do. I trust my boss. I trust my boss because we have conversations all the time.
Here's something.
So I come out, I don't feel like I'm stuck. I feel like I can talk to her. I feel like I can tell her, okay, I think we may have a problem here. You better be careful. You might get hurt. Something might happen.
Can I stop you for 1 second? I have a couple questions.
Sure.
Are you reasonable? Are you the reasoning mind or the reasonable mind?
I'm not. I'm the lizard brain.
Okay. Who's in charge, her or you? Who's the boss? Are you the boss or is she the boss?
Well, we have a multifaceted corporation, and I guess, yes, she's the boss of the corporation, not me.
Are you sure about that? So she tells you what to do?
Well, I think that she considers, ultimately, she's responsible for the outcome of the corporation. And even though I'm the lizard brain, I guess that I have to trust her because if she dies, I die.
So if she's responsible for the outcome, then who's kind of in charge of monitoring you and controlling you and making sure that you don't get too high and mighty? Like, what voice is that?
I think that would be her voice of the rational mind or thinking mind.
Right. And we're back into the mind, trying to deal with emotions, trying to deal with the body. Because here's the thing. The self, Alicia, is just a concept. Really what makes up her are her 10,000 different voices or 10,000 different minds. And so what is you're saying, I think, is what Alicia's hopeful belief is about this corporation, that ultimately she's somehow solid, substantial, in charge, conducting this orchestra, like you know, like controlling what voice has a right to speak, what voice doesn't have a right to speak. And we're back to kind of the controller, and we're back to the intellect or the rational reasoning mind, you know, which is kind of who I feel like I'm speaking to right now. You follow? Okay. You know, I get it.
I'll get more lizardy. It's really difficult because I guess if the lizards can only just do fight or flight, then how does the lizard really have feelings?
Right. And the lizard actually isn't necessarily the one doing fight or flight. You know, that's the body. So we're blurring the lines big time right now. And I get it. The lizard brain, you know, when I asked to speak to the lizard brain, we're not actually playing a game anymore. It really exists, you know? So allow me please to speak to the voice of the lizard brain. To whom am I speaking?
I am the lizard brain.
So all this talk about the fact that, you know, we are managing or controlling you or conducting the orchestra that is you, or like you're only allowed to speak when we say you're allowed to speak. Does that seem, you know, because here's the thing, you come out in a crisis. It's like, that seems like a crisis to me.
I come out all the time. I mean, I'm the lizard brain, so I'm always just constantly looking and feeling and just being on guard. And, you know, sometimes things are safe and sometimes things aren't safe. And so I guess if I'm perceiving safety, I go back in and do my thing, primitive thing. If I'm not, then I would keep persisting until I feel that I'm really being listened to.
So back to my original question. The question is kind of along the lines of, okay, how long do I have to listen to you and let you do your thing before you shut the hell up? That's the question that was being posed. And so why don't you answer that?
As a lizard brain?
Yeah.
How long does she have to listen to me?
And give you respect and consideration before you'll shut the hell up.
Well, I don't think that I ever really shut up. I think I'm kind of always there. I just go about my business. I'm not fearful all the time as a lizard. I eat, I go looking for love. I do all kinds of autonomic things.
Right.
that's my life. To keep safe.
It's disrespectful to you. And let's call you a child. It's like turning to a child, you know, like that whining child that I keep depicting. And it's like, sweetheart, what's going on? You have something to say. Okay, I will give you my undivided attention only because I know if I do this 4-step art of fear method that it'll shut you the hell up. Like, it's really, no kid's going to buy that. You're not going to buy that. None of these shadow voices are going to buy it. Fear's not going to buy it. And so the question more that we should be asking, I guess, is, you know, how can we just continue to have an honest, healthy, loving, kind relationship with you? And then through that relationship, you'll just organically not have to speak so loud.
Well, I don't feel, I mean, I guess what I'm trying to say is that I think that I have that open relationship to be able to talk and be heard.
Okay, and that's really what we're going for. So thank you. I wanna move on. We have a lot of questions left. As the lizard brain, is there anything else you'd like to say?
No, I'm just gonna go about my regular business. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. And if anybody else wants to volunteer, then please do. This next question, we also want to have another volunteer. In sports, as I get older, how do I deal with growing fear of getting injured? So especially if you find this question particularly enticing or intriguing, please volunteer. In sports, as I get older, how do I deal with growing fear of getting injured? And that's kind of, you know, let's actually wrap a bigger question around this. How do I just deal with growing fear as I get older? Because by the time, you know, I'm 51 years old, I've seen a lot of stuff, right? So let me read her question, though. Her fear has to do mostly with the reality of getting significantly injured as she ages. She's a skier. It gets scarier doing what she used to do effortlessly. Injuries take forever to heal. Also just had another injury just a few months ago and anticipates when it heals, fear will be even worse than before. So, okay, any volunteers for this? Well, while we're waiting for volunteers, and if not, I'll use Alita. So Alita, maybe you can unmute yourself and let me just kind of tell you my story.
I think I'm unmuted.
Okay, great. Okay. So just bear with me for a second. This is going to be, let me give you some background, because this is obviously something that I'm going through with too. I've had a lot of injuries. I'm getting older. I'm 51 years old. I'm still kind of skiing. Alaska, 4 weeks a year. You know, it's a lot, 55 degree slopes. And I was the best in the world at my sport for a really long time. And now my goal in skiing is to get worse and worse every year and be okay with it. And I don't know how old the person is that asked this question. So I'm 51. And here's the thing, our injuries afterwards, of course we feel fear and we should be afraid. We should be afraid of getting injured because injuries take so long to heal, because injuries are more common. You know, our bones become more brittle. We can't do the things that we used to unless we train really hard. And even if we train really hard, we still get injured a lot more readily. And, you know, when you're out there skiing, I know this is a ski question, it's super violent out there. Like, it's, you become very aware of how easy it is to get injured or tweak your back or blow a knee out, all of that, because we've had all this experience. So, in many ways, our traumas, our injuries, our failures, our divorces, our getting fired, all of those things are here always to make us more and more magnificent. And let me break it down. Like, how do you make a sword? How you make a sword is you plunge it into hot coals until it's glowing red, and then you pound it out, and then you plunge it into cold, and then you pound it out some more, and then back and forth. And it's like, this is how you make a sword. And so we go through these traumatic experiences, and you know, if we're willing to kind of really own and embrace the trauma, the injuries, the failures, all of that, you know, we just start to become more and more beautiful. And there's a saying in Zen, to lose it all is to win. And all this is a roundabout way of saying that you should be afraid, and the fear is here to keep you safe. And the fear is here to tell you, hey, you might want to slow down a little bit. And I know that's probably not the answer that you want to hear. And I don't know how old you are, but whoever asked this question. But what happens is, you know, we're kind of in this river called life. And all these things are happening. And so, Alita, let's do this. Allow me, please, to speak to the voice of the stone in a river. To whom am I speaking?
The voice of a stone in the river.
Just close your eyes and feel what it feels like for you. Like, I feel as the stone in the river that I don't want to move. I can't move. You know, there's change all around me. Only there is change. And I just want to maintain my same level of athleticism, my same level of strength, my same body, my same mind. I'm a stone in a river. Tell me about you.
I'm a stone in a river, and the water is cool and refreshing, and all my sharp edges are smoothed out and round, but I'm not going anywhere. I'm just staying at the bottom of the river.
Right. So in that beautiful poetic response, you both outlined the wisdom of you. Like what you kind of can slowly become, just as the stone in the river, you know, at your most polished state. But you also outlined the delusion of you and how you may hold the self back. And so this is a kind of a nuanced voice. And just kind of go with the flavor or the feeling of you rather than trying to understand, you know? So just notice what else you feel as the stone in the river. You know, I feel heavy. I feel unmoved. I'm not willing to go with the flow. I can't go with the flow. Anything else you want to say?
No, all those were perfect.
Let's do another voice then. Because oftentimes when we want to just stay the way we are, like I don't want to get to be a worse skier. I don't want to have brain fog. I don't want to lose parts of me that I, you know, that I've been developing, you know, like get worse as a skier. Oh my gosh, because I'm getting older. It's like there's a clinging to that and an aversion. And that's where a lot of our suffering comes from. We cling to something we once had. We have an aversion to who we're organically becoming next. So allow me, please, to speak to the voice of the parts that are fading away.
This is the voice of the parts that are fading away.
And these voices are really lovely for people that have questions as they're getting older. You know, the parts of me that are fading away. For me, my ability to remember where my keys are fading away. My skin is kind of like its suppleness is fading away. How about you? Let me hear from you. What are some parts of you that are fading away?
In my work, the excitement is fading away. The newness is fading away. Wanting to try new things is fading away.
Now, allow me please to speak the voice of the parts that are growing. To whom am I speaking?
The parts that are growing.
So for me, my knowledge and understanding of what to do about fear is growing. My ability to be in my marriage and have it be a calming experience instead of a crazy experience is growing. How about you?
My thoughts about myself are becoming more positive. Uh-oh, where did you go? Sorry.
We can hear you. Keep talking.
The things that I'm learning about fear are growing. The acceptance of myself and who I am is growing.
And just to finish this question in the sport of skiing. So for me, having been a professional athlete, like I used to do 70-foot jumps, flips, flips on life or death terrain. Those parts have long since faded away. And has my need to prove something or to kind of validate my existence by how well I ski, right? They're still there, but they're fading away. And there are other parts of me growing with regard to skiing, like my appreciation just for being there with my friends. My appreciation for how lovely an experience it is to go up to Alta on a day where the weather's really bad and nobody's there, but the few people that are there are hardcore and it just feels so like otherworldly if it's foggy, you know? Like, that's kind of where we're going with sports eventually. Like, can you not cling to what you used to be, but actually kind of not be the stone in the river and kind of let the river take you where organically you're supposed to go next? So last thing I'll say, it's like, oh, if whoever asked this question is like, oh, I don't want that. I'm not ready for that yet. I want to be a better athlete. So notice if you can't swallow this fish, but you also can't spit it out either, and just kind of contemplate this. Thank you. Moving on. How to deal with setbacks. Also regarding injury, so going back to the last question, if you have an injury, you have a setback, there's more fear showing up, always just go back to the art of fear method. You know, while you're recovering from your injury while you're kind of going through a setback, just please start the practice again. If you haven't, you know, dropped off from the practice, and start your 2 or 3 minute a day Art of Fear method, and you'll be dealing with the setbacks and the emotions, the negative emotions, the negative thoughts, all of that around them without having to repress them. And so they won't come back to haunt you later on. When should I pull in my thinking mind or intellectually reflect on emotions? Okay, I'm going to need another volunteer. And we've kind of gone through all of our volunteers. If I don't get another one, you know, Teresa, just be ready to go. But I want to give somebody else a chance. So before we get to the volunteer, though, let me just outline the questions that were asked. Because a lot of people asked some variation of this. Because a lot of people are just really have built a shrine to their thinking mind and their intellect. And so naturally, of course, you want to wonder when we're supposed to put our thinking mind or our intellect on emotions. Like, when do we kind of conduct that orchestra again? You know, like we're like the last question that I asked that I spent so much time on with the lizard brain. So here are some of the variations of this question. I'm a science-based person with not a lot of fear and anxiety and couldn't come up with a time on the last month when I felt terrible. Now, actually, let me pause with that one. Couldn't come up with a time in the last month when this person felt terrible. Now, there may be a few things going on. Like, if your life is going really, really well, you don't have a lot of arguments with people, like things are just running smoothly at work, right? Either you're in just wicked flow with your life, right? Like, here's the hose, and here comes fear, here comes anger, here comes frustration. Here comes joy, here comes love, here comes success, here comes failure. Like, you're in flow with it and nothing really bugs you when they just come into, through, and out of your life and you embrace them all. That's called flow. Great if that's what happened. The other thing that may be going on if somebody doesn't feel like they have a lot of unpleasant emotional experiences is that you're just really good at ignoring or avoiding bad feelings. Let's take avoiding, for example. The last time I felt like my life was going really well and that I had no problems was I was in no relationship. I was taking no risks. I was playing it super safe. So I was avoiding fear. And of course, if you avoid fear, things feel like they go pretty well. If you're ignoring fear, then you're just really good at kind of blacking it out. But of course, there's going to be ramifications for that. You kind of touched upon that. I'm jumping around a bit, but maybe you remember the stoicness or maybe just feeling dull in order to not have highs and lows, you know, because life organically is supposed to be highs and lows. Or the other thing that could be happening if you don't feel like you have a lot of highs or lows is there's just nothing really has happened that's bad in the last month. But, you know, maybe in that exercise with false self, we could have like gone and in the last year, the last 6 months, because nobody's without a false self and nobody is without these unpleasant feelings. So that's just an aside. Let's keep exploring though, thinking mind, the intellect. There's also the exercise that you talk about of weighing the fear of not taking action against the fear and making a change, i.e. staying in a relationship versus leaving. I see this as an intellectual practice. So what this person is saying, and these are number of people sending these kind of questions, that we're using our intellect, and actually I'm about to talk about this in a second, but in the four-step Art of Fear method, absolutely we use our intellect, and I'm going to point out where. Next question, bottom line, my thinking mind wants to explore the emotions that keep popping up. What does that integration look like? For instance, say I'm waking up every morning and observing that I have anxiety. In that moment, I am being with the anxiety and just feeling it, and it quiets. But when do I sit down and say, where is all this anxiety coming from and what needs to happen next? So what I'm getting at is that a couple things. First of all, it's all in our mind. You know, these voices are the 10,000 minds, really, when you get down to it. Because without our minds, we'd just be tomatoes. We actually have to have the mind involved to play Shift the Game of 10,000 Wisdoms. We have to have the mind involved in every single part of the four-step Art of Fear method. Otherwise, we just collapse on the floor, right? And ultimately, the intellectual practice that is in the Art of Fear, you know, it ultimately is an intellectual practice. Certainly the first step, rationalizing and understanding that it's normal and natural to feel fear or discomfort or anxiety or any of these unpleasant things, not a sign of personal weakness. That is a very important step because it really appeals to our intellect. So I always want to kind of weave the intellect into it because it's such a big deal. The second step of the Art of Fear method, when we're examining what it is that we feel, where we feel it, and how strong it is, certainly when you identify, you know, all of these different kind of acknowledgments, the mind's involved, you know, the mind has to figure this out. And especially when we get to the scale of 1 through 10, that's all mind. Like, okay, it's the mind's interpretation of how strong the feeling is. So already the question was, you know, how do you integrate this feeling and thinking? The four-step Art of Fear method is already somewhat integrated, is what I'm trying to say. Yet, the four-step Art of Fear method is also trying to get you to have other experiences besides just your intellect or rational mind. So let's have our volunteer. Let me see if we have any newbies. We have a Q&A. Check in. Okay, look at Q&A. You talked about doing the Art of Fear method 10 times a day for the person who has panic attacks. Does that person need to wait until they feel fear or do it as practice to practice until it happens again? Let me just pause and answer this question. I recommend that if you have an overriding problem with fear in your life or panic or anxiety, that you do this method a lot for a week, like up to 10 times a day. Or for, I mean, you might even feel so much better after 5 times the first day that, you know, you might not even ever have to do it again. I don't know, but everybody's different. So I recommend that you do this in advance. Like, absolutely, if you have a lot of anxiety at work, you don't want to, like, go hide in the bathroom 10 times a day to do this method. You know, do it when you're at home. Do it when you get up in the morning. It's up to you to decide when you want to do this method. I talked about when I was about to give a speech and that I did it right beforehand. It's also something that you can do in a pinch, but let's take it back into skiing because that came up several times. If you do the Art of Fear method, like when you're snowcat skiing and, or when you're hanging out with some buddies and you're at the top of the slope and you're like, hold on guys, I got to take 3 minutes to do my Art of Fear method. No, that's not probably going to be appropriate and it's going to be kind of weird for the people around you who don't know about this method. I recommend that you do it at home before you go skiing, and then you can just quickly kind of check in if you need to, if you're having problems on the slope. So just in summary, I recommend that you do the Art of Fear method just as a daily practice, and also when you're about to do something really scary, when the need arises. Okay. So let's get Teresa back.
Okay.
All right. So bringing it back to where we were, we're talking about the intellect and when is it appropriate to bring in the intellect? And like I said, with the four-step Art of Fear method, we already kind of employ the intellect. But I want to just really have everybody have a crystal clear sense of the difference between thinking about your emotions versus feeling your emotions. So you ready?
Mm-hmm.
Allow me please to speak to the voice of the one who's thinking about her emotions. Whom am I speaking to?
The one who's thinking about the emotions.
Okay, so do your thing. Tell me, what do you think? What do you think about?
Well, trying to figure out where they're coming from. Okay. But yeah, there's got to be a reason that they're here. So I'm just trying to figure that out.
Okay, so think about, like, one of the emotions is sexuality. Let's just go for broke. You know, we're in the last 20 minutes of our 4 series, right? Like, what do you think about sexuality? Go ahead and think about that.
Mm-hmm. So my mind is racing. I'm going through.
But it's great. I think that a lot of people have problems accessing their sexuality. A lot of you know, like we could talk for days on this subject, right?
Mm-hmm.
Let's do something a little bit more PG. Think about fear. Go ahead, just go nuts. Think about fear all you want.
Oh, I have a lot of thoughts about fear. Fear is really inconvenient and comes about at a lot of the wrong times and tends to really freak Teresa out. really, you know, gets my mind racing as to why it's here. And, you know, why is fear showing up again? And how can I get rid of fear?
Right. And ultimately, our thinking mind is the go-to voice for a lot of people when it comes to their emotions, like trying to understand where the emotions are coming from, understand what to do about them. And next thing you know, we're in our heads a lot when dealing with emotions. Now, emotions are with us all the time. And so if Teresa's default is to think about her emotions, she's going to be in her head all the time. And one of the primary causes of monkey mind or just being super analytical, not being able to have an experience other than the thinking mind, is if somebody has been kind of thinking about their emotions forever. Let's check in with fear and see how fear feels about this. Allow me please to speak to the voice of fear. Who am I speaking to?
Fear.
Your job is to be afraid.
Yes.
You're pretty simple. I want you to look at the voice I just spoke to, the one who's thinking about you. And, you know, I know Teresa's in a relationship with Sean, right? Like, if Teresa even were in a relationship and Sean, all he was doing was just thinking about Teresa, that'd be a little weird, right?
Yes.
Right. Trying to figure out Teresa. Trying to figure out where Teresa's coming from, right?
Yeah.
But it would be a little weird for Teresa, right?
So, stalker.
You know, having this voice, the one thinking about you, the thinking mind, constantly thinking about you, trying to figure out, trying to solve the problem that is you, how does that make you feel?
A little creeped out. but, you know, I'm not that complex and there's nothing to figure out. Oh. I mean, I'm just afraid.
I'm just afraid. All right, now we're going to do super rapid fire here. Now allow me please to speak to the voice of the one who's feeling her emotion. To whom am I speaking?
The one who's feeling her emotions.
Okay. So just notice what it's like to be you. Feeling emotions. Not much to say, right?
Mm-mm.
Not very complicated. Nothing to figure out. I'm just feeling. I'm not feeling and trying to understand emotion. I'm just feeling emotions. And the four-step Art of Fear method, the last step is all about you. Like you're just the one that's, and let's just switch to feeling fear. And, you know, we could do feeling sexual. You know, we got to keep it PG. I'm just having fun with you. But the one who's feeling fear, so just be you. Whom am I speaking to?
The one who's feeling fear.
Very simple. Anything you want to say?
My first instinct is I'm really uncomfortable.
Right. It's uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
Uncomfortable emotion. Or is it possible that Teresa feels uncomfortable with you?
Definitely possible. Real and probable.
Right. Are you the voice of feeling fear and judging whether this is a pleasant or unpleasant experience?
No.
Right. So what I hear in that statement is that you're the one that's feeling emotions, but that there's some other voice that's interpreting you as being an uncomfortable feeling.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Especially with men, you know, who are taught explicitly, like, not to feel your emotions, in the military, taught not to feel your emotions. Like, you are explicitly taught in our culture. And so no wonder the self finds you uncomfortable. Especially if you're feeling fear. Now, if we did the voice of feeling joy, less so.
Mm-hmm.
Right? But it still might be awkward for people. You know, everybody's different. So allow me, please, to speak to the voice of fear. Who am I speaking to?
Fear.
Okay, so back to Teresa and Sean. You know, if Sean was just feeling Teresa, that'd be okay, right? Mm-hmm. So as the voice of fear, how do you feel about just Teresa kind of dropping off and the voice of the one feeling their emotions? How would that make you feel? To just be felt?
It feels like I'd be able to do my job better, that it'd be more efficient. I wouldn't have to get as loud or angry or obnoxious, because they wouldn't be questioning why I'm there.
Right. So I'm going to move on because we have a little mm-hmm. bit of time. We're running out of time. Thank you very much. Here's the thing. Our mind is kind of like a puppy. Puppies are chewers. You know, they chew on things. And it's important that we give them appropriate things to chew on. So chew on this. And now let's just kind of everybody be in their rational thinking mind, one who's trying to understand. Thinking about emotions is kind of like thinking about the universe. It can be very fascinating. It can be very consuming. There's a lot going on with our emotions. But the thing is, you second you understand something, it changes. You know, the universe is constantly changing. So it's really hard to pin anything down, and you can get lost in that practice forever. But if you just learn how to feel your emotions, it's so much more simple. But keep in mind, I have admitted that I've invited the rational analytical mind into the Art of Fear practice, and I've given them something to chew on, you know, the first step, and then also kind of trying to identify where it is. But when we get to the fourth step, you know, it's beyond our rational mind. And the fourth step, where you feel your resistance and feel your fear, that's actually really the meat of the method. So hopefully that answers your question. And then the other thing that I want to say, when you get the sheet, when I send it to you after this webinar, there's a bonus step. And so I want everybody to just kind of close their eyes and feel their fear. And the bonus step is where you just notice the percolation of energy of that emotion, or the percolation of energy of any of the shadow voices. And then if you've done the fourth step out of fear method, you know, this is the bonus, you do it afterwards, you then kind of ask that discomfort what message it has for you. And this will definitely engage the intellect. You know, what have I been avoiding? You know, that what is your message to me that by avoiding you, the voice of fear, I have been avoiding entirely? Like, maybe fear has been trying to get you to go to a doctor. Maybe fear has been trying to get you to have that difficult conversation with your husband that you've been avoiding. Maybe fear is trying to get your attention that it's time to quit your job. So that's where you incorporate your thinking mind. So let's get Alicia on for the next question. Should we practice mindfulness? Is the next question. And I know that this is kind of erratic and jumping around, but there's a lot of us here, and I wanted to just address in super practical terms all of these questions, and hopefully you're getting something out of every single one of them, even if you didn't ask the question. So especially if you have a scientific mind, likely you're in your head about your emotions, which is a form of repression. It's a way to not have to feel your emotions. And mindfulness meditation, while great, also keeps you in your mind, which is called why it's called mindful. So I suggested to this person, I sent him an email, that mindless meditation actually might prove to be a better choice, especially if you're in your head a lot. So allow me, please, to speak to the voice of mindful. And we'll all do this together. Whom am I speaking to?
I'm the voice of mindful.
Okay. So just close your eyes and notice that we're full of our mind. And then a quick shift. Allow me, please, to speak to the voice of mindless. Or we could call you the one who's free from thought, or free from mind, or empty mind, or no mind. How about no mind? Whom am I speaking to?
I am the voice of no mind.
So as the voice of no mind, I see some other names for you are emptiness, I want you to look at the self. Tell me, what do you see? What is she like?
I can't think. I have no mind.
Right. Well, notice what's happening. It's like if we only are willing to be mindful or be in our minds, you know, yes, we can't think, but there are some forms of intelligence that exist beyond thought, and you're one of them. So I just kind of said that as a gift to the, you know, the mind, the one who's trying to understand. So allow me, please, to speak to the voice of non-thinking. We'll give you another name. Whom am I speaking to?
I'm the voice of non-thinking.
I want you to look at the self, and you can still speak. And we can have a little sliver of the mind in here, just to make sure that you can represent yourself. As the voice of non-thinking, I want you to look at the self and just see how much she thinks and how much she is in her head. Can you see that?
I can.
As the voice of non-thinking, no mind, the one who's free from thoughts, what do you offer her?
Well, I think that I offer her the freedom from thinking. I offer her the ability to be free and just to feel and enjoy life and all those things that you don't really need to think about.
And you notice you started your sentence with, I think that.
Oh.
And it's like, we have to have the mind here on some level just to play this game. And so that was kind of the one sliver, the 1% of this voice that was speaking.
I feel that.
Right, right. And so this practice, this shift game of 10,000 wisdoms, is a really gorgeous, rich, multi-layered practice. Like we have 10,000 voices at our fingertips. And when we're in flow, all of them are available to us because there's always room for something else to enter. And so I don't want to finish with you because I want the group to understand something. But so why don't we kind of half incorporate you as one wing and mindful as the other wing? So allow me, please, to speak to the voice of the one that consciously includes and embraces both mindful, you know, the one that has thoughts, and no mind, the one who's free from thoughts. The Buddha calls it the middle way. Like, can we just get to the middle way right now? And I'll say, who am I speaking to? And you just say, the one who consciously includes and embraces both these states. Whom am I speaking to?
The one who consciously embraces both of these states.
And ultimately, this is kind of where we're headed. You know, we had 6 hours to work together. It's been a gorgeous practice. We've been particularly focused on the voice of fear and all the associated voices around it. Today, we kind of stepped out of that box a little bit and kind of looked at some other voices, and I kind of rapid-fired, and hopefully I addressed everybody's questions either directly or maybe somebody that didn't submit questions also recognize themselves in some of these voices or some of these explorations. I encourage you all to do the Art of Fear method so that you can be in flow with shadow, with fear, with negative emotions, so that we always have something else to enter. You know, there's always room for something else to enter, such as no mind, such as the voice of silence. such as the voice of the infinite. This practice, there's just no end in sight. I say there's 10,000 voices. Really, there's an infinite number of voices. And if we can, you know, have a practice around each and every one of them, drop by drop by drop, we become a mighty river. So as we're rounding out, we only have a few minutes left. Somebody asked a personal question for me. After all these years of facilitating and practicing, do you have any voices left in the basement? And if so, does that concern you? And the answer is, hell yes. I oftentimes put full self in the basement. I don't even know I'm doing it. And I've facilitated that voice so many times. Some of the other voices that I found that I lock in the basement are the victim. I lock guilt in the basement. I lock shame in the basement. And yes, I still lock fear in the basement. And I don't even know I'm doing it. In fact, during the launch of my book, I was repressing fear for about 2 weeks, just that out of a whole old habitual pattern. And I finally realized, like, oh, that's why I've been feeling so bad. That's why I've been not sleeping at night. And so it's constantly a practice. We got to keep on working on it. And my practice actually is working with clients. You know, that's why I love working with you. That's why I love doing these webinars. And I just want to finish by offering you a support package, because I know this was a lot, you know, especially tonight. It's like I tsunamied you with like a million different directions and a million different unrelated questions. I have a support package. I'm not going to leave you hanging. The support package offers 4 accountability emails after this course is over, just offering you practices that are not in the book, that I didn't outline during this course because we didn't have time. It also offers you the online at-home course, which has like 30 videos and workbooks, worksheets, all of that. It's really rich. I'm super proud of it. We just finished it about a month ago. It also offers you 6 ongoing live webinars, small group, where you can ask me any questions and I'll facilitate you. And sometimes these groups can be only like 3 people, 6 people. And so you really get me privately. And it's only $379. It's very reasonable. If you were to get this whole thing from me privately, it would be thousands and thousands of dollars, probably about $4,000. So please consider signing up for the support package. So after this ending of this email, I'm going to send you the link for the support package if you want to continue this work and learn how to be in flow with your life. And also I'm going to send you the 4-step art of fear practice. Please practice it. Send me questions if you want. But definitely the best way to practice this in an ongoing way is through the support package. I made it super affordable. I hope you all sign up for it. And so let me just finish with a story about Gandhi. Gandhi was approached by a woman and her son one day. And she said, look, can you talk to my son? He's really overweight. You know, could you talk to him about stopping eating so many sweets? He eats a lot of sugar. And Gandhi looked at the boy and looked at her and said, well, yeah, come back in 3 weeks. You know, I'll talk to him then. She's like, okay. So she comes back 3 weeks later and she's like, I'm back. You know, here's my son again. He's still eating sweets. Can you talk to him? And Gandhi said, looked at the boy and said, stop eating sweets. And that's it. She's like, all right, well, thank you. Appreciate that. But why didn't you just say that 3 weeks ago? And Gandhi said, 3 weeks ago, I myself was eating too many sweets. So what I am is I'm just a couple pages further along in the book you're reading. Well, I actually wrote the book that you're reading. And I have been doing this for about 15 years. And I just want to tell you that it works. And I am practicing this, and it has had such a profound effect on my life. I no longer have the PTSD and the burnout and the adrenal fatigue and the hatred of skiing and all of the problems that came at the end of my ski career after repressing fear. I feel so much better. I have had horrible relationships in my life, and now I have the most amazing relationship. People call us and interview us for their books about what to do in relationships, me and Kirk. And like, this stuff really, really works. And it's effort. It requires some effort, but it's a whole lot less effort than fighting a war with fear or fighting a war with your shadow your whole life. My specialty is shadow, but I also take people on a journey of different states of consciousness that you can't even believe, that we just briefly touched upon at the very end. I hope to continue working with you. Thank you for showing up. Thank you for showing up present, focused every week. And as always, I end by bowing and saying thank you for engaging in consciousness practice with me during these last 4 weeks. Not only does it have a profound effect on your life, but it also profoundly affects my life. Now you understand that better. And also, we can't even begin to measure the impact that it has on the whole world.
Hey, Kristen, there's still a Q&A that you should address. Great question.
All right. Ooh, we get one more question. If a person wakes up in the middle of the night with fear, would the person do the four-step method at that point as well as doing it before going to sleep? Oh my gosh, that's like my favorite question. The one thing that I have figured out how to do that is so remarkable is what to do about insomnia, like if you're awake in the middle of the night. So if you have chronic insomnia, absolutely do the Art of Fear method in just your daily practice, certainly before you go to bed, when you get up in the morning. You know, depending on how bad your insomnia is, I recommend doing it quite a few times a day. And then if you get woken up in the middle of the night, what that is it's either fear just showing up as fear itself and kind of running its agenda physically, or coming out from the basement, hijacking your mind and running its unfulfilled agenda in a loop, and it shows up as monkey mind. So what I do in that moment, you have to wake yourself up a little bit, because we tend to think that, oh, you know, I want to cling to what grogginess I have, you know, as a way to get back to sleep. So you got to resist that urge. You also have to resist the urge to do what you've probably been trying to do for years, which is go and distract yourself, you know, get out of bed, go read, or, you know, just walk away from the monkey mind or the fear. And instead, wake yourself up a little bit if you need to, and then turn towards your body, like do a body scan, like the second step, and just notice what you feel. And if you keep doing this over time, it'll actually be less of a mental exercise and more of just a physical exercise. Like, what is keeping me up right now? And sometimes it's your body, sometimes it's your mind, and you just turn towards it and just let it do its thing. You either feel the fear or you give the monkey mind its stage. You just let it do its thing. And it works so well that next thing you know, I wake up, it's 2 hours later. Like it's instantaneous. Of course, I've been doing this for a while. It may take you a while to figure it out. If you're having a hard time making it work to resolve your insomnia, then please sign up for the support package or maybe send me an email and I'll give you a couple more pointers. But it works, and it works in seconds once you get good at it. So that's it. That's like my favorite question. It's like my favorite thing. I just hope that people call me about insomnia. It's the one problem that I can solve super fast for people. It has a profound effect on their ability to sleep. So with that, is that another question? Thanks. Hey, you're welcome, Richard. All right. Well, goodbye from Florida. It's really hot. I'm sweating. Those of you that are in snow country, I'm jealous. All right, not really. But it's been wonderful working with all of you, and I hope to see you in the support package. Our next live event is coming up in about a month. So thank you.